pull them in early.
Yeah. For a 5-minute hearing. Senate Judiciary and Public Safety Committee will come to order. For the record, this is March 10th, 2011. Members, today we have two overviews. One is on the Board of Public Defense, and the other is Civil Legal Services. We'll start with the Public Defense today. Welcome to the committee. Would you identify yourself for the record?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Chairman and members, for the record, my name is Kevin Kyer. I'm the Chief Administrator for the Board of Public Defense. To my right is William Ward. Mr. Ward is the Chief Public Defender in the 4th Judicial District. Mr. Chairman and members, we were before you, I suppose about a month ago, maybe already, and gave an overview and talked at least a little bit about the budget. I'm going to go through just briefly, if I can, just highlight a couple of those overviews in terms of who we are and what we do, get in kind of the budget situation that we're in now or the financial situation we're in. Mr. Ward would talk about some of the particulars, and I guess, Mr. Chairman, with your permission, go through the budget request and kind of where we all stand. If that
sure, that would be fine. Go ahead. Mr. Kyer.
Sure. Chairman and members, just as a background, you have a piece that we believe is in your packet. I'm not going to go through all of that, but you at least have it, and obviously if you have any questions, we'd be happy to answer those. Mr. Chairman, the Board of Public Defense is a judicial branch agency. We provide constitutionally and statutorily mandated services on the trial and the appellate levels. That's all that the board does. Public defenders cannot refuse cases, and their workloads and caseloads are controlled almost exclusively by outside factors. We represent about 85 or 90% of all clients that come through the criminal justice system on felonies, gross misdemeanors, and juvenile offenses. At the same time that public defenders cannot refuse cases, they are also held to the same ethical standards that private attorneys are held. As I mentioned, the public defenders represent about 85 or 90% of those charged with those serious crimes. Probably 60 or 70% of the misdemeanor cases that come through the system. Those percentages are pretty standard across the country when you look at other public defender or appointed counsel systems. Mr. Chairman, as we talked a little bit about last month, the board continues to struggle and to face some significant financial challenges. Those begin on page 7 of your handout. In its February 2010 report on the public defender system, the Office of the Legislative Auditor stated that public defender caseloads are too high, resulting in public defenders spending limited time with clients, difficulties preparing cases, and scheduling problems that hinder the efficient operation of the criminal court system. And I just want to give you a few examples of kind of where we've been in the last few years. From 2008 until 2011, those fiscal years, we've lost 63 attorney positions. That's roughly 15% of our staff. To put it in terms of for some of you attorneys, that's 120,000 hours of attorney time. Caseloads right now are nearly double the ABA and board standards. Our part-time public defenders, which we talked a little bit about last month, provide about 40,000 additional hours beyond what they're compensated for in any given year. And that's just to keep those cases flowing through the court system. In about half the counties in Minnesota, we are not there for first appearance, when you're in custody or out of custody. In a 2010 report, in a July 2010 report, the National Center for State Courts did a study on judicial workload assessment. One of their major findings was the judges are forced to wait when public defenders are in other courtrooms or other hearings, and public defenders are forced to ask for continuances when they are not adequately prepared due to the high volume of cases that they handle. If you're in Hennepin County or Ramsey County, and Mr. Ward will talk a little bit about this, is one thing to be down the hall. When we're in greater Minnesota, we're in the next county, and you can imagine what kind of problems those create. With our impacts on the judicial system, again, the legislative auditor noted, high public defender caseloads are dragging down the justice system. Courtrooms are idle because the public defender is tied up in another courtroom, or in some cases another county, as I mentioned. The result is a loss of accountability. Victims are upset and witnesses disappear. Last month, or I guess it was January now, you may have seen a Star Tribune front page story on the court system. One of the main elements of that story was the case of a woman down in Olmsted County who had been sexually assaulted. Her case had dragged out for almost 2 years, and she finally decided it wasn't worth it for her to go through that criminal justice system again. Nobody wants that, but that's where we're at in a lot of places in the state. I want to give you a few more examples. In Sherburne County, up in Elk River, I was there not long ago. Between 9 o'clock and noon that day, the courtroom stopped four different times because the public defender had to go and be down the hall in another courtroom. In the 7th Judicial District, we had a situation where one of our defenders was conducting a jury trial. They were slipped a note by the bailiff asking when there's a break in the case, could they come down and handle the juvenile calendar down the hall because the other judge was waiting down the hall to handle that juvenile calendar. In the 3rd District, you may have read where one of our lawyers is being held in contempt by one of the judges down there because they weren't in two different counties at the same time. They had a jury trial scheduled in one county, and they had three trials scheduled in a county one over. And I bring that up not to mention the judge or deny the judge or even the court, but the frustration level that people are feeling right now because they can't get their work done. Public defenders, prosecutors, judges, all of those folks that work in that court system. Not to mention, as the legislative auditor did, the victims and witnesses that we leave waiting. In the 9th Judicial District in Grand Rapids, we have a managing attorney in that office who also covers International Falls. It's 119 miles one way. He leaves on Sunday, stays over Sunday night, handles the Monday calendar, stays over Tuesday, or Monday night, handles the juvenile calendar on Tuesday, then drives back to Grand Rapids on Tuesday afternoon. He's also supposed to be managing that office and supervising the attorneys and staff in that office. In Olmsted County, we have caseloads now scheduled out 14 months, for trials, I should say. Last month, I was down in the 3rd Judicial District meeting with some of our lawyers down there. We had one new attorney. She'd been with us since, I think she said, early in 2010. She's had 1 week since July of last year where she hasn't had at least one felony trial scheduled, and that was the week she was on vacation. She tells me that two felony trials scheduled is the norm, or two trials scheduled, I should say, sometimes as many as six in a day. I had another attorney who had been with us since 2009, and she came to work. She started doing felony work shortly after she came to work for us. She came into court, had a felony case, and was told she was going to try that case that day. She had just started working the felonies after some other public defender had left. She was told she was going to do a felony trial that day. She hadn't met the client. She hadn't reviewed the file. She hadn't obviously discussed the file with the client. She ended up getting a lunch hour, 2-hour lunch period to review the file with the client, and that's how that case ended up proceeding. On the appellate level, and I think that the folks from the appellate court told you, we just flat out cannot meet the timelines that the appellate court and the Supreme Court have. We continually ask for extensions on those timelines, and I think Mr. Ward will talk a little bit about some of the issues related to those, not necessarily the delays in the appellate process, but the delays in speedy trial demands, because we've had some breaks in that system already with a couple of fairly newsworthy cases. Some of the other issues that our folks have been dealing with, ethics complaints. We've had several ethics complaints against our lawyers, again, mostly for time-related issues, not returning phone calls. Can't get in to see my lawyer. You name it, that we've had it. Health-related issues, we've had a number of issues where stress-related, these are folks in their 30s and 40s that you just would never expect that those kinds of issues would come up. We now have a grievance over caseloads filed by our attorneys. That issue will be going to arbitration. We just found that out this week. They'll be going to arbitration on that issue. And a turnover of experienced staff. One of the things that's very critical to us is to have experienced lawyers, particularly in that, let's say, 4 to 7, 4 to 10 year experience range. Those are the folks that know how to do cases. They know what they see. They can take cases and, for lack of a better term, cut corners. And we're seeing a lot of those folks starting to leave our system, sometimes for more money, although not always, but always for smaller caseloads. And, you know, that's just everybody to a person tells me that when they leave. Those are some of our issues that we're dealing with right now, Mr. Chairman. I want to talk, obviously, about the budget. I guess at this point I'd like to turn it over to Mr. Ward to talk a little bit about the speedy trial issues and some of the other one more specific issues, and then if we come back and kind of give you an update on where we are budget-wise, status quo, and kind of into the future, if that works.
All right. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Ward.
Mr. Chair. William Ward, 4th District Public Defender, Chief Public Defender. By way of introduction also, before my appointment there in early 2009, I was the Chief Public Defender of the 10th Judicial District, so I'm very aware of the rural issues that occur in our office as well. It's kind of hard to put these things into perspective as far as just as a lawyer and also as a manager. When Mr. Kyer talks about people leaving the office, I just got a call yesterday from another lawyer who's resigning, also because of the results of the caseload increases. We had someone who resigned over a month ago, again in the 4th District, and someone last year as well. And I just told Managing Attorney Bob Sorensen, I got a call from a lawyer who's in an administrative position in Wisconsin, that one of my lawyers is interviewing with them for a job there too. You know, just the gift just kind of keeps on giving, to be honest with you.
Mr. Ward,
yes, sir.
Pardon me. In some of these positions that have people have left the job, are those positions being filled again?
They are not at this time, sir.
And do you know why?
There's a hiring freeze that's been instituted by the State Board of Public Defense. What we're trying to do, we're towards the end of this fiscal year, obviously, trying to manage our budget as best as possible through June 30th. I've been able to contract in some respects with some folks due to the emergency problems we've been having, but I have not hired a lawyer in the 2 years that I've been there.
So the hiring freeze has been on for at least 2 years?
Mr. Chairman, we blink it on and off depending on, you know, what the budget situation is, but it's been on for quite a while.
Who's the one that blinks it on and off?
Mr. Chairman, that would be me.
All right.
And right now, I will say we just finished our fourth round of voluntary separation incentive programs as well, in anticipation of July 1st coming in and, you know, not being able to meet budget. So, okay.
Please proceed.
But, Mr. Chair and members, these are folks that we've invested highly in since 2006, this last round of hires, especially in the 4th District, and these are the folks who are leaving as a result of the crushing caseloads. To put things in perspective, there has been a lot of news regarding the speedy trial demands and people's cases being dismissed. Those of you who are lawyers, I know you would understand this, that if we demanded speedy trial in the cases we have now, we would shut the system down. Ethically, we do not do that because we are not prepared to demand trial in all the cases. But the timelines that were instituted in this state in the 80s, it's 5 days speedy trial for a misdemeanor, it's 60 days for a gross or a felony. It's 7 days speedy hearing on violations of probation. We're not meeting any of those. I mean, we rarely demand trial because we're rarely in a position, due to our staffing and our caseloads, that we are prepared to demand on all these cases. The realities are we're barely meeting the omnibus issues within 28 days of filing the motions pretrial regarding search and seizure issues or identification or suppression issues. What we do is, once the case has been appointed to us, we do the best we can to prepare ourselves through research and investigation on doing these cases. The problem becomes when you have double what the American Bar Association recommends, for whatever that means. It's too many cases. It's too many people to see in the jail. It's too many cases to be prepared adequately. So there are delays. It's not a delay because we can't wait for other cases to come in. It's a delay because we're not prepared to go forward. We are in a situation up here where, and I said this last time I was in front of all of you, that it is an embarrassing thing to admit as a chief public defender, one of 11 or 10 in the state, that we're not meeting the needs of our in-custody clients at the bail hearings. In half the counties in the state, there are no lawyers to represent people at the bail hearings. That's a travesty. In the other half of the counties, we don't have the lawyers available to represent out-of-custody clients at the first appearance. These are times, in some respects, that we can resolve these cases so long as we have the reports, but because we don't have the bodies available to be present, these cases have to be continued again and again until we're prepared to represent our clients effectively. That is a travesty. We are also faced with, because of technology and the advent of DNA, a lot of jurisdictions have gotten federal money to deal with what they call cold hit cases. I'm sure you've seen these in the paper. We have not gotten the same funding. So we're dealing with these cold hit cases. We're dealing with difficult forensic issues and people who are being brought in and charged on 6, 7, 5, 10-year-old cases. As aside from that, and everybody should know this, is that we're dealing with clients who are facing more time in jail. And I will tell you this from 25 years of experience of clients, they are more animated, they are more angry, there are more mental health issues than I've ever seen in my career. Just last week, last Wednesday, one of the clients attacked one of my lawyers in the jail because he didn't do what he wanted him to do. That's the kind of stuff we face with. You know, I get people who call and yell and scream and swear at me every single day. I'm used to that. But when I got folks attacking my lawyers in the jail, and this isn't the first instance here, this is going on more and more in all the districts, that clearly is an issue regarding the ability to see the client as much as we should be, the communication issues that we need to be dealing with, the ability to be in the office to answer the phone and talk to the clients about their cases, let alone going to the jail. That's where we are failing because we're in court so much. Right now, as it stands, it's important for this body to understand that we are not equipped to do our jobs the way you would expect us to do them and the way the citizens would expect it. We are short 15%. You know, in places like Hennepin County, when you have one building for the most part, or in the suburbs, to deal with these cases, you can somewhat absorb it because you're running to one simple courthouse. When I was in the 10th, covering 8 counties, the difficulty in dealing with multiple defendant cases in these last-minute settings because of warrants becomes impossible. If we get cut additionally, and I'm just saying this because it's the reality, right now I cover 3 suburbs. I cover Southdale, Ridgedale, and Brookdale. I have 10 lawyers covering those 3 courthouses. I get cut anymore, I'm not going to have the lawyers to do those buildings. And in those buildings, we go and run through cases. It truly is McJustice. But at least the clients are being served in the jurisdiction where the arrest is occurring. I won't have the bodies there to even do those cases. And you're talking about 10,000 to 15,000 cases a year that are handled in the suburbs. That's what we're faced with. I also want to state, and I'll stop at this, is that I want everybody to understand that we have done what we can within the agency to be as efficient as possible. I recognize efficiency seems to be the catch-all phrase these days, and it is important that there isn't waste in any government, even in the private sector. But some of those efficiencies I have no control over. Appointments, obviously. Cases being calendared when I'm aware of it. But we've worked so hard that we're changing in the 4th District our system of dealing with the calendars, and it hasn't been done in this way since 1988, where we are going into divisions that deal with the excess loads with less lawyers. I don't know if it's going to work. But I do know in the meetings I have with all of the chief public defenders, everyone has looked at every single county calendar situation to see if we can do it better. We're strapped. This is the best we can do. And at this, we're failing what we should be doing.
Any questions for Mr. Ward? Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Kyer. Just a couple of real quick questions, and I want to try and move quickly because, you know, we're under the gun here. But list for me, if you would, the state-mandated services for the public defenders.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Newman.
Mr. Kyer.
If you look on pages 2 and 3 of your handout, it's constitutionally mandated services in felonies, gross misdemeanors, misdemeanors, and juveniles by statute for children 10 and over. And then on the appellate level, criminal appeals, post-conviction proceedings, and statutorily mandated service in end-of-confinement review appeals.
Okay, Mr. Chairman.
Yes,
Mr. Kyer, and if I understand correctly, then by statute, I'm just going off of your mm-hmm. chart, it's children over 10 years old in child protection cases, end of confinement reviews at the appellate level. Those are the only two areas of statutorily mandated services you are currently providing.
Right.
No longer providing any kind of representation in CHIPS or any of that type of thing?
Mr. Kyer.
Chairman, Senator Newman, no.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Newman.
What is the percentage of your caseload for the statutorily mandated services?
Mr. Kyer.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Newman, on the end of confinement review cases, we do probably 120 to 130 a year, something like that. To put that in perspective, there are probably 700 or 800 appeals, or I should say cases, that come through that office. Not appeal, briefs aren't filed in every one of those. There's probably about 3,500 or 3,600 parole revocation hearings that office does. There's some other, you know, miscellaneous I'm not thinking of right off the top of my head. We certainly can get that to you. But so there's about 120 of those cases. The representation of children over 10, I would have to break out for you, because we don't represent parents in child protection cases anymore. We represent those children over 10. However, in Hennepin County, we do continue to represent parents, because the county provides a substantial contribution to that office every year. That is the one county, one district where we have combined funding that continues. So I know statewide we probably have about 3,500 or 3,700 total child protection cases, but I can't tell you right off without looking at how many of those are parents versus children.
One final question, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Kyer. If you could maybe give me a breakdown of the numbers. Yep. I'm just trying to get an idea of
Absolutely.
The breakdown of statutorily mandated services versus constitutionally mandated. I would appreciate it. Then one final question. Explain to me what is currently happening in terms of asset or income evaluation for determining whether public defenders are going to be assigned to a case. In constitutionally mandated cases.
Mr. Kyer.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Newman, I guess in what respect, what's...
Senator Newman.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Kyer, not everybody, at least back in the days when I was doing it, qualified for a public defender, and I'm just trying to find out what currently is the criteria which is used for a judge to appoint a public defender to represent someone.
Sure.
Mr. Kyer.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Newman, that is outlined in statute. The driving force of that, if you will, is whether or not someone in the home is eligible for means-tested benefits. There are other provisions in there, but that's the real driving one. And then whether or not someone in that locale could afford private counsel. But those are outlined in the statute. We can certainly get that to you.
Right. Thank
you, Mr. Chair. When you give me the other information, if you'd give
Absolutely.
Me the site, you'd
yep.
save me the research. I'd yep. appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Mr. Kyer, the portion that Hennepin County pays for public defenders to be involved, what is that in CHIPS cases? Is that where the where the money is directed?
Mr. Chairman, it's not directed specifically at that. Years ago, when the state assumed the cost of public defender services, and I don't think you want me to go through that entire history here. That's for another day. But basically, there wasn't enough money to do all the things that needed to get done there. And there, part of it was budgeting issues. Part of it was just, you know how things work around here, is there just wasn't enough money. So the county has contributed for the last 20 years annually to that office. And I think this year, if I'm not mistaken, it's probably somewhere in the neighborhood of $6 or $7 million.
7.2.
But it goes to, I mean, it's all in one place. It doesn't go specifically for several items. But CHIPS, representation of parents and child protection cases, rent, most of the technology expenditures for that office. Obviously, they've got to be integrated with the rest of the county. And it's obviously to the county's advantage that that happens. You know, just the cost of doing business.
So. Mr. Kyra, the money that you said 7.2 million, is that enough to cover the involvement in the CHIPS and the rental and the technology? Is that enough, or is the state picking up any balance?
Mr. Chair,
that?
Members, it is enough. We've apportioned, you know, when it was first broken out, it was way underfunded as far as the apportionment, but I would easily say that about 2.5 or so million of that dollars could be apportioned to the CHIPS parents.
And then the manpower allocation in the 4th District with all of these other responsibilities, is that drawing your personnel away from a public defender, the traditional constitutional role of a public defender?
Mr. Chair, members, I would say no. You know, the contribution, obviously, I'm very happy with from Hennepin mm-hmm. County. They recognize, and I have these hearings, if you will, with the county board, and they recognize that it is a cost savings to them for them to donate money to our agency other than them hiring private attorneys to do it in a separate bill.
I do not believe,
based upon we've apportioned bodies, that it's a drain on the other things we're supposed to be doing.
Okay. And the other question I had is in some of the other judicial districts like Ramsey County or others, am I to assume that public defenders do not get involved in these auxiliary services that Hennepin County requires of you?
Mr. Chairman and members, the only one that, you know, as I said, were the representation of parents in child protection cases, and we do not do that. We haven't done that since July of 2008, I think it is, that we got out of that.
All right. Any other questions? Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you.
You're kind of
Thank
being
you,
shy
Mr. Chair.
Today.
with Hennepin County putting in some funding here, there are no other counties in the state that do any additional funding, or is that to handle that additional workload that you talk of?
Mr. Kyra.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ingebrigtsen, the other places where this comes into play is there is a statute that provides for expert witness fees for folks who are unable to afford those. Doesn't necessarily mean they're always public defender clients. But under the statute, we can or an attorney can petition to the county or to the court at county expense to provide for those expert witness fees, expert witnesses, translators, those kinds of expenses. And so there is some minimal contribution on you know, around the state on that issue as well. Hennepin provides that as well.
Any other questions? Senator Hall.
Thank you, Chairman. It's not really a question. Again, I just want to say you guys do a great service to our state. And if you have a lack of funding, I think we should try as much as we can to get that funding for you. You know that one of my sons was a public defender. He was tireless in the work he did late at night. As a matter of fact, he couldn't get married and couldn't have children, grandchildren for me because he worked so hard. Seriously. He's now out of that after 5 years. But I just so appreciate, and didn't always, but I so appreciate what you guys do and the time and effort you put into it. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Mr. Ward, you made mention of times when your department or agency will contract with other attorneys. And is there a particular time or circumstance that you need to hire? Is it just simply because of caseload? Or is it due to the nature of the particular case? Or is it just, why don't you just give us an idea of when you do that?
Sure, Mr. Chair. In the past, before I got there, I believe that it was done oftentimes on certain conflict cases because there are so many different people who are charged with an offense. And we have a conflicts unit that would handle some of those cases, in-house we would handle, and if we needed an additional lawyer, they would contract for that to occur. Since I've been there, we've done that on a couple of occasions, but for the most part, when there was an emergency that the State Board was dealing with last year regarding the shortfall of our budgets, the State Board had authorized us to contract with people for a period of time. And what I did was I was provided with the funding from the State Board of Public Defense, and we then contracted with lawyers to basically handle calendars. Mr. Sorensen was involved in those contracts. Most of the folks were able to bring in full-time. They were paid substantially less than as if they were actually hired by our agency, and they are not employed by our agency. They're actually contracting to do the work. I did it on an hourly basis or a monthly basis, and the contracts were to run out by the end of actually of this month.
Mr. Ward, are these attorneys that you would hire, would they be relatively new attorneys, or would they be experienced criminal lawyers, or would it be pro bono type work other than the hourly that you've made mention of?
Mr. Chair, I think by the hourly I'm paying them, they would look at it as being pro bono work. I could not hire recent graduates because there's no way they could do the casework that we are expecting of them. My expectation was and is that they would be assigned a calendar, they would pick up those cases, and they would start. I didn't have the time to train them. So all of them were very, very experienced lawyers. We're quite fortunate. Maybe it's because of the economy. I'd like to think it's because they're trying to help us as well. There are some pro bono lawyers, Mr. Chair, and members who have been helping us out on some more complicated mortgage fraud cases. They're doing those cases for free, and we try to do that as much as possible, but there's a huge reluctance on taking on some of these more difficult criminal cases.
That raises another question. When do you feel confident, or what are the qualifications of an attorney that you feel confident in that can represent a client before the court? How much experience does an attorney need to be up to the game?
Mr. Chair, members, I think it depends on what kind of calendar we're handling in which county. I think that a lot of younger lawyers and newly barred lawyers can handle most misdemeanor-type offenses. There are some difficult cases that involve, of course, DWIs and domestic violence-type cases. As I've told, I'm sure, this committee before, my goal is you don't practice on the poor, and I'm not going to hire somebody who doesn't have the experience to represent these people from Jump Street. In the last round of contracts, I was fortunate that I think the youngest lawyer of experience was 4 years, and some folks have 25 or more years of experience who've contracted with me to do this work, so I'm very, very fortunate. It's more difficult outstate. I had a much more difficult problem on this in Pine County, Isani, and say Chisago. I have it's a much easier for me, Mr. Chair, to do it in the metro area to get more experienced lawyers. I got to go with my gut, and we would interview the person. We would ask for specifics regarding how many trials, how many jury trials, how many court trials they've been involved in, the type of cases they've been involved with in the past. And you have to do your homework to make sure that you're getting accurate information.
Any other questions? Mr. Kyer, in relationship to the budget, a lot of talk about budget shortfalls. In your estimation, where are public defenders on a percentage basis? Are they funded adequately now? Are they 95% of what you need? What would happen if you had a cut face your operation by a where's the breaking point?
Mr. Chairman and members, we're at the breaking point. To answer your first question, I think Judge Neville was here when the court made their presentation, and he indicated that public defenders are operating right now at about 60%, 55 or 60% of standard, which is pretty accurate. In other words, we would need probably another 300 lawyers, full-time equivalents around the state, to bring us up to the caseload standards set by the ABA and by our board. We know that's not going to happen. But that, obviously, that's the ideal.
Percentage-wise, what does 300 represent?
About a 45% increase over where we are right now.
With that much of a shortage on staffing, how do you satisfy a constitutional requirement to provide a public defender to those that require it?
Mr. Chairman, I guess I would turn that over to Mr. Ward, but I think we're in danger of not doing it, to tell you the truth. I think we are. I think you've seen some of those cases publicized recently. But
Mr. Chair, members, I think for years public defenders were reluctant to admit that the work that they were doing was ineffective. When the auditor did its survey, because it was anonymous, I think people were much more honest about what they do in representation of their clients. When you have responses such as they've spoken to their client 5 minutes before the hearing and it's a contested or a hearing of substance, there's no way we're meeting the constitutional mandates that were set forth in all the cases in this state and in the United States Supreme Court. We do the best we can, but I will not sit here and tell this body that we are doing really well. It's embarrassing to admit. It's under my watch. It's under Mr. Kyer's watch, of course, Mr. Stewart's and the other chief's watches. But we have people who are beating themselves to try to do the work they can. As Senator Hall pointed out about working nights and weekends, no family life, mental health issues, personnel issues that I'd never dealt with before as a manager are coming up now. So are we making it? A lot of our clients would say we are not. I didn't devise the American Bar Association standards of 400 case units per year. I don't expect in my lifetime we'll ever get there. But if we start getting down to 550, 600, I'd be one happy camper, and I know our lawyers could do a lot better job. I know the courts would feel better, and with the clients, because we'd be resolving these cases faster and better and with client communication. But there are times, I'll give you an example. I don't mean to belabor the point. In places like Isani County, I saw Judge Hunter Anderson at a meeting not too long ago, and he was happy as the judge that their trial calendar got down to 42 cases on that trial. 42 cases. There's three public defenders there. 42 cases on the trial calendar, and he's happy. Pine County, 60 cases on the trial calendar on a given trial calendar every 2 weeks, or every two Mondays in a row, and then a month later it's two Mondays in a row. They're happy at 42 cases. I have lawyers when I was in the 10th District setting literally 12, 15 cases for trial on a given day, and they didn't have any choice. I have lawyers in my district now in the 4th District that are being forced to set 4, 5, and 6 trials in a calendar call when a private lawyer wouldn't be asked to set more than one. And we've allowed this to happen, and I'm as guilty as anybody else because we've kind of gone along, we're going to do the best I can. We're at that point. We're beyond that point. And I tell you we're beyond that point when we're not representing the clients who are in custody for their first appearance at a bail hearing. The judges are being put in a position to set bail without anybody arguing for them as to what it should be. That, to me, tells everybody in this room and anybody who's listening we're beyond that point already.
Sarah Hall.
Yes, thank you, Chairman. I would like to just reiterate my son had 170 cases at one time. There were times he said he didn't talk to his client before he went before the judge. He didn't have the 5 minutes to do it. He did feel really guilty about that, and I think partly added to the stress of what they go through. He was new. I think he made about $35,000 to $40,000 a year. The burnout rate for these guys, I think, is about 2 years. And they could probably clarify that a little bit more. And I think this is happening on our watch now. And to me, we need to take this very seriously, especially when the judges in the system are saying to us, we have a problem with it. This is not the public defenders. This is our judges that are saying we've got to do something here.
Thanks. A question that I might want to ask is with the caseloads. Before caseloads are established for public defenders, there's a screening process to qualify whether or not the defendant is actually qualifies for public defender. Tell me about how does an average screening work? Is it different in every district, or is it a little different? Is it customized for every judicial district? And then what is there a cutoff point? Do you take into account expenses versus income? Do you take into account maybe they just inherited some property, they don't make a cash flow, but they've got a family farm back home that's worth $500,000? How does that work?
Mr. Chairman, let me take a stab at some of the statewide issues. I think maybe Mr. Ward can comment and fill in some of the blanks. By statute, the state public defender has to recommend or produce the form for eligibility, and he does that. It's in the rules of criminal procedure. I will tell you that not every court is using that form, and the eligibility screening, I think if you read the legislative auditor's report from this time last year, would say that it is different in all places. Having said that, the auditor also found that the vast majority of people who are getting public defenders are truly indigent and need that service. So are there some variations? Yes. In instances, as you cite, where there are folks that maybe inherit property or have some property, I know those are looked at. Sometimes they do slip through the cracks. When they have, when there are those egregious cases, we have reported those. We took a couple of those all the way to the Court of Appeals to say, hey, this person is not eligible. They have substantial assets. But it is all over. And when you have 288 district court judges, they are going to do things differently. But as I said, the auditor's report found that the vast majority of folks are eligible. But
Mr. Chair and members, the courts and I may not agree on a whole lot of things, but I will tell you they do a very good job on the screening, either through the screener and collector in individual counties or the judges themselves. They recognize the plight we're faced with. They recognize that we can barely handle the cases we got and that we should not be appointed the people who aren't eligible. You know, the 4th District, it really is not an issue, and that's a third of the cases in this state. I will tell you, as a chief public defender, when I was in the 10th, and I've done it once since I've been in the 4th, when a person was appointed to us, it was clearly an egregious appointment. I have, me personally, have gone to the courts and asked to be withdrawn as a result of the error of the appointment. I guarantee you, and Senator Hall, your son would probably agree with this, if one of our lawyers is appointed to a person who clearly is not eligible, they bring it to our attention. They don't like the fact that they're getting cases where they're overburdened already, and you know they see the court looking the other way. It really doesn't happen much. When it does, it makes big news, and people get upset about it. I don't blame them. But overall, I think the system works very well with the court being involved in this process. And I will tell you, prior to coming to the state in 2001, I was a lawyer, a public defender in Illinois, and the Cook County Public Defender's Office was responsible for that screening process. And that's we don't want to go there. It is so difficult to have the lawyers be involved in not only interviewing their clients but to determine eligibility. It just doesn't make any sense. The system we have here actually works very, very well. There will always be examples that fall through the cracks. And frankly, the things that are difficult are the ones where the client's making $10 an hour, he doesn't have any kids, he's charged with a non-person felony crime. You know, is he eligible for our office when he can't hire another lawyer? And it's the gray area that we hear about, too. But, you know, I think the courts do a very good job overall.
Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Kyer or Mr. Ward, are there instances where an individual who has had a public defender appointed been ordered to make at least some partial restitution to the public defender program?
Mr. Chairman,
Members, there is a reimbursement statute that allows for the ordering of reimbursement for public defender services if, as in Mr. Ward's case, in that instance he cited, where you've got somebody that's employed, making some money, probably can't afford a private attorney, there is a provision for them to reimburse for public defender costs. Those reimbursements go to help offset our part-time defenders' overhead. As I mentioned the last time I was here, about half of our staff is part-time, and we contribute a very minimal amount to their overhead. And so several years ago, I'm thinking it's 16 or 18 years ago, the legislature put that reimbursement statute in place and then directed those to part-time defender overhead.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Senator.
Quick follow-up to that, Mr. Kyer. From what you and Mr. Ward are seeing, are the district court judges appropriately using those statutory guidelines so that the program, the reimbursement program, is in fact working in accordance with what the statute says?
Mr. Chair, Senator, sure. The goal is that we don't get the cases in the first place. And I believe as district chiefs and as managers, we've done a much better job over the past 7-8 years of explaining to the court that if they're not eligible, don't appoint us and have them reimburse us. Because the reimbursement amount is so little compared to the amount of effort and work that goes into doing these cases. So the goal is to not have us be appointed if they're not eligible in the first place. Overall, I think the courts do see that gray area, and they do apply it. But again, in the 4th District, I don't think there's any reimbursement to any of the part-time staff at all the last two fiscal years because there weren't anybody who really fell within that guideline. In some districts, there's greater reimbursement, in some there's less. But the goal is to not be appointed to the cases in the first place.
Any other questions? Senator Ingerbritzen.
Immigration issues, is that becoming a larger consequences on page 6? Can you describe that for me a little bit?
Mr.
Then I'd like to ask Mr. Turner a question. Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chairman and members, that's part Carter. Of the budget request that we have is a small amount of money to deal with immigration consequences. And I want to state from the outset, it really isn't about immigration as so much as it is about collateral consequences and what our lawyers are now responsible for. The U.S. Supreme Court in the Padilla decision, which is cited in that document that we handed out, has now said that criminal lawyers are responsible for informing folks about the immigration consequences of a conviction or a plea. So that is now on their watch or their burden, if you will, just like any other thing. And they can be found to be have ineffective assistance of counsel if, in fact, they haven't provided that assistance. It's a whole new area of law that, frankly, our folks are not up on, never had to be. And so we are struggling with that issue. So it isn't an issue of, I think, as I said, immigration so much as it is what our lawyers are responsible for. And I don't know if Mr. Ward might have some comment on that.
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator, it has become very onerous. To give you an idea, where the federal government would say the case is a felony, for us it would be a gross misdemeanor. The gray area on deportation is something, frankly, I never paid attention to. I mean, clients would talk to me about it, but ultimately my responsibility was to do the best I could, explain to them their trial rights. If we went to trial and they were found guilty, it was considered a collateral consequence. We have spent umpteen hours now training our lawyers to deal with the nuances on federal immigration issues and what it means if you are convicted, say, of a disorderly conduct or domestic violence, what 365 versus 364 days as far as a sentence is concerned. And the reality is that we have seen the case law. If we don't do it right, it comes back. And the courts have been involved with us. They're curious as to how much they should be talking to the clients about whether or not they are naturalized or non-resident aliens, you know, how far they can go into these questions. The issues are pretty unclear overall, but we've been provided the responsibility by the United States Supreme Court to do what we're supposed to do so these cases don't come back. And it's taking a lot of time.
Senator Ingraham.
Just a follow-up. Can you give the, maybe with a little more research, you probably not have it at your fingertips, but a little idea how much more time that's causing per year? If you can get that back to me, I would certainly appreciate that. Additional time? Growing, if it's growing, and by how much?
Mr. Chair, Senator, are you talking about how much more time we're spending with the clients?
That's right. Everything.
Okay.
And my second question is with regards to budget. Could I have Mr. Turner give me just a quick overview of what they're requesting and what the governor's proposal is?
Mr. Turner?
Mr. Chairman, members, just for the record, the public defender budget request that's in your packet, they have the mainline public defender system viability, which would fund personnel costs to at their defined adequate levels. For 2012, the request is $9,223,000. In addition to that, they have $700,000 request for appellate transcripts and expert witness fees for a total of $9,923,000 for 2012. 2013 is $12,350,000 for system viability, another $700,000 for transcripts and fees, for a total of $13,050,000. So the 2012-13 biennium request from the public defender is $22,973,000. Then the governor's budget came in at a 5% in a system-wide increase, and that comes to $3,236,000 each year for a total of $6.5 million for the biennium.
And what is the total budget allocation that the governor is presenting?
The Public Defense Board base right now is for the 12 and 13 biennium is $129,452,000. With the governor's request of $6.5 million, it would the governor's budget proposes the biennial budget to be $135,924,000.
Mr. Chairman, just one adjustment on that viability request. Part of that request was to fund the loss of one-time funding. And as some of you may know, is the state Supreme Court has continued a $75 attorney registration fee for the next two-year period. So that's roughly about $1.8 million per year. So that would come off of that viability request. In addition, we found out this week, actually, that our federal stimulus grant is going to be renewed at least for another 6 months or a year. So while we were projecting to lose about $1.2 million over the biennium, it's down to about $1,900,000 that we're losing.
So, Mr. Carrier, what is the federal stimulus dollar amount?
Mr. Chairman, the extended amount is $291,000, I believe. And basically what they did is they took money from some of the unspent grant funds in some of these other areas, and they awarded it back to some of the folks who had, frankly, done a good job of documenting need and those things, and we were very pleased with that. So, but the original amount was about a little over $1.1 million for the biennium.
Mr. Kier, that temporary attorney licensing fee that the court extended for 2 years, is that – I know most attorneys didn't like it in the first place. But those of us that are licensed have professional licenses, it seems like all of the licenses are going up. So – we can all grumble about them, but I'm thinking that it was a disproportionately higher for attorneys. Do you know?
Mr. Chairman, I really couldn't comment on that. I will say that the Minnesota State Bar Association was very supportive of that $75 and, in fact, testified in front of the state Supreme Court in favor of that $75. So, but I can't tell you what it is relative to some of the other professions we license.
I almost forgot about Senator Goodwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Kier, I'm kind of interested. I've heard over the years and just recently that people that were not eligible for a public defendant that were unemployed and not and even not collecting unemployment, so they had no income, people that were on Social Security disability, and were told that the Brooklyn Center court is the closest to my district, so that we're told that they weren't eligible for public defenders. So I'm wondering if the income eligibility changes based on some criteria. For example, if you don't have enough attorneys to cover enough cases, or, you know, is there a set income? Like, is it 100% of poverty level, or 133%, or what is really the, and is that different in different areas? Because I have heard quite a few people that were not eligible, that at least in my mind, if they had what they said or didn't have what they said, I would have thought they would be eligible. But
Mr. Chairman,
yes, Mr. Kay.
Senator Goodwin, it doesn't change based on our circumstances. Those requirements or those eligibility standards are set out in law. I can't comment on the individual case. I don't know the circumstances. I think what we find sometimes is folks may not have income, but maybe they have assets, and that may be some of the situation here. And so if somebody's looking at it and saying, hey, you've got assets here that can be used in one way or another. And you know what? There may also be mistakes. I mean, just as we make mistakes or find mistakes that are made the other way, where people are probably not eligible and they get a public defender, I'm sure there are some instances where it's the other way around.
Oh, Mr. Okay. Chair, just to complete that. First of all, is a home considered an asset? So if they have a home, they'd be kind of expected, no matter how much value or lack of value that home had. And then my second question was, is there, again, I want to find out, what is that line? Is it 100% of poverty level, or what is it?
Mr. Okay. Chairman, Senator Gruden, a home would be considered an asset in okay. terms of when the court looks at, you know, income and assets. There isn't a specific dollar amount or percentage of poverty level that's in the statute. As I mentioned earlier, is if the driving, two driving, real driving force in the statute are, one, is somebody eligible in the household for means-tested benefits, and secondly, I can't remember the exact wording, if it was hardship, or if somebody couldn't afford to go and find a private lawyer in that locale. Those are kind of the two drivers right now. Those are two of the issues that the legislative auditor had with eligibility criteria. They felt it was too general, as opposed to having a specific, you know, hard and fast income threshold. And, you know, we can debate that, you know, the income versus assets part, but there isn't a specific income level that triggers an appointment.
Thank you.
Mr. Kier, you and I were talking a couple days ago about other legislation that goes through the legislature, and I didn't quite connect public defense expenses with the improvement in technology, or whether law enforcement prosecutors are using technology to exact a criminal case against an individual. And in this case, we were talking about an issue of familial DNA. That's a bill that's beginning to make its way into the legislature, but that bill will affect the public defender's budget. And could you use that as an example of what your department, what costs that could trigger, or any other technology that's now connected to defending a client? Because I think our committee kind of forgets about that type of thing, and we need to know that as we're making our,
Mr.
our
Chairman,
analysis this year.
Sure. There are a number of things that do. You hit on one, the DNA issue, which has obviously been a huge issue lately. And Mr. Ward referred to the cold hit cases that they get. I know that the Hennepin County Sheriff's Office got, I think it was a $500,000 federal grant to do some of these cold hit cases maybe a year or two ago. Our entire budget for expert witnesses outside of the 4th Judicial District is $120,000 a year. So that was just that influx of those dollars, which now all of a sudden, and Mr. Ward can speak to, you know, what that means in terms of bringing those cases forward. We had a case in Ramsey County here that was a homicide case that was over, I think it was 30 years old, if not more. That was a cold hit case. We had a lawyer spend the better part of 6 months on that case, going through DNA training, going to figure out what exactly, you know, is there, isn't there. I believe we ended up getting an acquittal on that case, if I'm not mistaken. There are other areas. We are in process right now of a pilot project on e-disclosure down in Olmsted County, where the prosecutors can send all of the material electronically to us. That provides a great opportunity for all of us, but it's also a severe challenge for us. Data lines to have to transmit all of that. Who's going to organize those files? Do we have the capacity computer-wise to be able to hold these? Because you're talking about, for a felony homicide case, you might be talking about box loads of discovery, photographs, videotapes. That all has to be kept somewhere at some point. We have a problem right now because in a lot of places we can't take laptops into the jail, and even if we can, the file belongs to the client. So a lot of times we have to, if we do get that electronically, we end up printing it out and having to take it to the jail or the courtroom when we print it out. So there's another additional cost to us. As I mentioned, about half of our staff are part-time. We provide no computer support for those folks. So they're out there on their own. If they don't have a data line that can handle, if they don't have a PC that can handle that material, they're out of luck. In fact, I was just down in the First Judicial District a few weeks ago talking to one of our part-timers about the problem right now that he has because he gets the disks from the prosecutors, and the amount of time it takes for his secretary, which is privately paid, to transcribe what's on that disk so that he can take it to the jail and he can read through it with the client. We're going now to videotapes or to CDs. Great, except they take about three times as long to go through a video for a lawyer as it does to get a transcript and read through it. Because you don't know on there when the client is going to say something, when the interrogator is going to say something, when there's some admission. When you're reading through the transcript, they read through it, they can scan through it for words, they can make notes on it. So we recognize that these things are all, you know, good inventions, if you will, and I think they were going to be very time-saving for some of the other parts of the judicial system. We just don't have the resources right now to be able to keep up with that, which is one of the reasons we're doing the pilot down in Olmsted to find out exactly what is this going to entail. I will tell you right now, from what we found, we have a half-time secretary that does nothing but take that e-discovery, file it, print it out so that our lawyers have it and are ready for court, and she can't keep up, and that's half-time. That's just in Olmsted County. So those are some of the issues, and I don't...
Mr. Chair, members, I mean, in specifics as far as DNA is concerned, until the end of last year, there was only one software that was available to all of our lawyers in the entire state to look at the DNA, and it happened to be in my office. The software and the hardware is very, very expensive, but there's one that we had available that lawyers would contact Mr. Sullivan in my office to have them to review the disk that the BCA generates. The technology is getting better. Hopefully it's getting cheaper, and we want to buy and purchase some additional machines, but then we have to have people trained to read the stuff. As technology gets better, though, as you can imagine, the threshold amounts that's necessary to say whether it's a so-called match or not lowers itself, too. And then we have the huge costs of the experts, the statisticians as far as whether or not, you know, one in a billion is the accurate number for multipliers, and whether or not there's contamination or more than one DNA sample present. So there is a huge cost to us in that. As far as the case management stuff, I've seen the future. Hennepin County has spent a substantial amount of money, and it is a wonderful thing. Mr. Sorensen and others have been involved in this project of a case management system, but it has cost Hennepin County millions of dollars, and we're still not off the ground yet on what they call or recall the American Defender Project, which will deal more with e-filings and case gets versus having to double up the entry and the information in the system. So as technology occurs and our either allies or adversaries are given the funds to deal with this stuff, we have always been left behind and have tried to make our own way, either through our trial team, training people in-house. I mean, it's somewhat sad, but we're doing the best we can.
All right. Thank you, gentlemen. We gave you a little over an hour and covered a lot of ground. I'm glad you came. Gives us a little more understanding of your work and some of the pressures on it. Hopefully by next week we'll have some detailed numbers in our budget area, and I'm sure we'll talk again.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. The next group is the Civil Legal Services. We have with us today Mr. Gary Hurd, Chief Operating Officer of the Southern Minnesota Regional Legal Services.
Southern Minnesota Regional Legal Services.
Right. And Mr. Jerry Lane, Executive Director. Welcome, Mr. Hurd.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Were you going to be starting out today?
We're going to leave it to Mr. Lane today, Mr. Chairman.
All right. All right.
Mr. Lane, Chairman, Gary had all the fun last time, so. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for your time and the opportunity to talk about the role of civil legal services to advance the state's obligation to provide access to justice. I am Jerry Lane. I'm the former executive director of Mid-Minnesota Legal Assistance. Together, Mr. Hurd and I are representing the Minnesota Legal Services Coalition to provide a budget overview of the civil legal services component of the state's budget. The statutory basis for the civil legal services appropriation is cited in this slide. As Mr. Hurd noted in his testimony the last time we appeared, we do not assert any constitutional right to counsel in civil cases. If there was one, we'd have more money and I'd get paid better. but there isn't. However, our state constitution does make a promise. It says that every person is entitled to obtain justice. And when you took your oath of office, each of you became a guardian of that promise. And when I took my oath as an attorney in this state, I took on a responsibility to help keep that promise as well. We believe that civil legal services is an essential component of any effort to keep that promise for the roughly 750,000 of your constituents whose limited financial means makes them eligible for our assistance and who need it to give them access to justice. The statute assigns the responsibility for implementing the statute and administering these funds to the Supreme Court's Legal Services Advisory Committee, or LSAC. The statute funds services to provide a range of civil legal services in a range of civil matters. It pays some special attention to the needs of family farmers and designates a portion of the appropriation for family law services. With oversight from the Supreme Court, the civil legal services programs from throughout the state have created a system which reaches every county and every corner of the state. As part of that system, the Minnesota Legal Services Coalition is comprised of seven regional legal assistance programs that deliver services in every county. Another 24 smaller programs receive assistance to serve special communities and to focus on special practice needs. This network of civil legal services providers serves roughly 53,000 Minnesota families each year. The service and benefits provided by the civil legal services programs are supported by a mix of private funds, federal funds, and state funds. In 2008, the last year for which complete information was available until this afternoon, that combination of resources supported roughly $38.4 million in service. As I was waiting to testify this afternoon, Mr. Chairman, I got an email from the Supreme Court Administrator's Office that the projected number for 2011 is not $38.4 million, but $33.4 million in funds. So there are significant losses independent of what happens in the legislature to our system. In addition to those funds, about $15 million worth of pro bono legal services are made available through the coordination and support of our program staff. General fund support from the state constitutes roughly one-third of the total funding for civil legal services. I'd like to talk today not only about the state general fund appropriation, but also about other state-administered funds under the Supreme Court's direction, what we refer to as the three-legged stool of state-administered funding. As I noted earlier, the Supreme Court works through LSAC to allocate the state-administered civil legal services funding. In fiscal year 2012, we project this mix to include, number one, the attorney registration fee revenues of about $1.8 million, or roughly 13% of the state-administered funds. That's the civil segment of what the public defenders also receive from the attorney registration fee. Number two is IOLTA, interest on lawyer trust accounts, which will be about $500,000, or 4% of the state-level funding. And third is the general fund appropriation of about $11.8 million currently, which is 83% of the state-administered funds. But these funding sources have been shifting, and I'd like to talk a little about the consequences of recent changes and potential changes. Since 1997, a portion of the fees attorneys pay to register to practice in Minnesota has been designated to support providing civil legal services to low-income Minnesotans. Minnesota was the first state in the country to do that, and Minnesota lawyers asked the court to assess that fee on their licenses. Up until 2010, the designated amount for civil legal services was $50 a year. Last year, the court increased that designated amount by $25 with a two-year sunset. And just last week, the court made the civil increase permanent, again with the support of Minnesota's lawyers. And that fee, the combined 50 and 25, will continue to generate about $1.8 million a year. A second key source of state-level funding is IOLTA, interest on lawyer trust accounts. This was established by the state Supreme Court 30 years ago. The IOLTA program has attorneys place small and short-term deposits of client funds that they are temporarily holding into an interest-bearing account, a pooled interest-bearing account. The interest is directed to the Supreme Court and used almost entirely to support civil legal services. In more normal economic times, the dollars available to allocate from that fund have been about $2 million or more. And as you can see from the graph, in fiscal 2008, $2.68 million was allocated from IOLTA funds. However, the decline in the economy, both in terms of attorney business activity and lower bank interest rates, has had a catastrophic effect on IOLTA allocations. And as you can see, there will be a 77% reduction in IOLTA allocations beginning July 1 of this year and running through both fiscal 12 and 13. We are going to experience a $1.7 million a year loss from $2.2 million to $500,000 in revenue available to support civil legal services for the next two fiscal years. That's the equivalent of a 14% cut in general fund support from the legislature for civil legal services. And I'd like to talk about the impact of that loss in a minute. The general fund support for civil legal services, which is the part of our revenue appropriated by the legislature, is currently $11.8 million a year. That's the level of annual funding being requested by civil legal services for civil legal services, and that's also the amount requested by the Supreme Court, and that is what was put in the governor's recommendation for fiscal 12 and 13. However, as you can see from the graph, general fund support for civil legal services has already declined by 11% between 2008 and 2010. This was a disproportionately larger reduction than was experienced in other parts of the justice system, making civil legal services the only part of the justice system with base funding below 2006 in real dollars. Mr. Chairman, you asked us to consider the impact of potential general fund reductions of 5 or 10%. But in addressing that request, I want to emphasize that even if there were no general fund reduction in support for civil legal services, that 77% IOLTA reduction is the equivalent of a 14% general fund cut. Mr. Chairman and members, I'm afraid that in terms of sharing the pain of these hard times, civil legal services and our clients are somewhat ahead of the crowd. Before we even consider potential general fund reductions, we will have lost the capacity to provide services to 2,650 Minnesota families due to a loss of 18 attorneys from the civil legal services system. A further reduction of 5% in general fund support would amplify the effect of those certain losses, resulting in the loss of another six attorneys who would serve almost 1,000 families. A 5% cut is just under $600,000 a year, shaved off of the current $11.8 million. A 10% reduction, of course, would double that to a loss of almost $1.2 million a year on top of the other losses and would translate into not serving roughly 1,850 families who would otherwise get help with critical legal needs. Adding this all up, when you combine the disproportionate cuts in general fund support for civil legal services over the past few years, the IOLTA revenue reductions, and a potential 10% reduction in general fund appropriations in the coming biennium, Minnesota civil legal services system would see case capacity reduced from just under 53,000 to 45,750 families per year as a consequence of removing approximately 48 attorney positions from the system. In summary, the Civil Legal Services and Supreme Court request and the Governor's recommendation for flat general fund appropriation could be considered a hold harmless recommendation, but only for one leg of the three-legged stool of state-administered funds. One of the other legs, IOLTA, is simply broken. As suggested in this quote from District Court Judge and former legislator David Knutson, doing more with less has long been a way of doing business at Legal Aid. We've been managing and adapting to serious budget reductions for more than a decade now. We've made staff and service cuts. We've also made helpful adjustments whenever possible, perhaps most notably in our case screening process, allowing us to prioritize and focus on addressing the most critical needs of the families that qualify for our services. We continue to work on other efficiency mechanisms such as online intake, which could enable clients at remote locations to ask for our services without having to drive 50 or 100 miles. We have developed shared training and support services. We've created efficiencies through technology. I've been in leadership, Mr. Chairman, for over 30 years, and squeezing the most service out of every dollar we get has been a driver in my life for all of those 30 years. But the simple reality is that at this point, further budget cuts are not things we can manage around. They will mean cutting core services. Recent budget cuts have resulted in a 10% reduction in the number of clients who receive extended attorney representation. But giving Band-Aids to people who need surgery is not how we keep the promise of justice, Mr. Chairman. What is being lost here is not just the client's benefit from the time they need with an attorney, but our ability to screen non-meritorious cases out of the court system and our ability to settle good claims without going to trial. And both of those capacities are critical to relieving the cost to and the burden on the court system. And that is why I encourage members to talk to their local judges about the benefit of civil legal services. The one way to make the problems of the court system worse is to cut civil legal services. These losses are on top of the chronic challenges and tight finances that we have faced for the civil legal services. We try to sustain the high value return we get from attorneys who work with the lowest compensation in the justice system, and the fact that in the good days before the last few years, we were only able to serve 50% of the people who came to us and were eligible for our services. And those numbers, of course, are going up in the down economy. We've seen a 40% increase in requests for services brought on by the impact of the recession. But budget and service challenges are, we know, the simple reality for civil legal services and for all Minnesotans. And that's why we did not request and are not seeking an increase in general fund appropriation. We are not asking the legislature to make us whole by restoring services lost to previous general fund reductions or the losses of other state-administered funds. We do ask you to consider the role of the justice system as a core government service as you work through this budget cycle, and that you strive to make decisions that maintain the integrity of the courts, the public defenders, the other parts of the justice system, and civil legal services, all as essential components of what Chief Justice Gilday has described as Minnesota's justice ecosystem. They all need to work for the system to function. Mr. Chairman, you are one of the most senior members of the legislature. I have just stepped down from my position after 30 years, and this is my last chance to tell you it's been a privilege working with you. Sometimes this body has been able to help us, and sometimes it hasn't. But I think we have shared over the years the belief that civil legal services for those unable to pay is an essential part of any effort to keep the promise of justice. And as you and your colleagues struggle to meet the enormous challenge you face this year, I know you may not be able to move us all closer to keeping that promise. I hope that you may be able to find a way to avoid moving farther from that goal. Mr. Chairman, Mr. Hurd and I would be happy to answer questions either now or as the budget process of this committee and the legislature moves forward. And as always, our programs are available to the people who live in your communities and throughout Minnesota to help provide access to justice for your constituents and all Minnesotans, and we welcome your referrals to the extent we're able to handle them.
Thank you, Mr. Lane. Any questions? Senator Marty.
Mr. Chair, first, Mr. Lane, thanks for your many decades of service. When you were going over, you said that today you found out that your revenues that you'll be working with are dropping from 38.4 to 33.4. I see like 1.7 or something was from IOLTA. Where is, and the state general fund portion hasn't been determined yet, where's the rest of that $5 million cut?
Mr. Lane.
Mr. Chairman, Senator. One of the things I've been proud of over the years is that civil legal services does not just depend on the legislature for funding. We have gotten our hands in every pocket we could find, and that's federal funds, state, county, local, foundations, United Ways, law firms. And so the other losses we are facing come from those other sources, local funds, United Way funds. I know, for example, my program gets funding from the Twin Cities United Way, and the funding available for legal services to apply for is going down by a third in the next United Way grant cycle. And so we anticipate a loss of at least $250,000 a year just from the Twin Cities United Way, just for my program. And so cuts like that are happening all over the place. Foundations took a huge hit and have not rebounded. Law firms, which we have been very aggressive in seeking funding from, are laying off staff, and we are seeing hits from that source. Local governments are hurting. So every source we've got is hurting, and so those other losses are coming from federal sources. Of course, the federal government's in deep trouble, like just about every state in the country, and so we're facing losses from every possible source.
So, Mr. Chairman, so that $5 million loss is all non-state general fund, that $33.4 million is if you keep the state – if you keep the state general fund where it is?
Mr. Chair, Senator Marty.
Mr. Lane.
Some of that loss reflects the loss over the last 2 years from the general fund. So that's about
1.6, I believe.
Yeah. The state Supreme Court Administrator's Office gets this data every 2 years, so the losses we have experienced that we have every expectation, obviously, will continue from the general fund is part of that $5.4 million loss. So the other sources would make up another roughly $2 million, local and private funds.
Mr. Lane, can you tell the committee what kind of cases does civil legal services get involved in?
Mr. Chairman, the two largest areas are family law and housing. For most of my time, family law and housing and access to minimum income, government benefits and unemployment, were three roughly equal pieces of our workload. at this point, just trying to keep a roof over people's heads has become the number one problem facing our clients, with family law second. And when I say family law, we have had to keep our focus narrow and focus on family law cases where there is abuse and neglect of a spouse or children. Cases where there is no such abuse, we refer out to private counsel for hopefully pro bono representation. So even within the area of family law, the focus has gotten narrower over the years. So those are the two largest areas of our service.
Do you do any overlap cases, let's say, with the jurisdiction of Human Rights Department?
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman.
Is there any overlap in your services with, let's say, the Human Rights Department?
I would say effectively not, Mr. Chairman. We have, over the years, worked out a very good cross-referral system. They know what we do well. We know what they do well. And none of us have enough funding, so we are more than happy to refer to Minnesota Advocates for Human Rights, the kinds of things they're good at and we're not.
Yeah, Mr. Lane, in one of your graphs on slide number 4, you have a breakdown, a pie chart of revenue sources. Now, that was based on 2008 figures, but is that correct? I have a 2008 on the top of the slide.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
But you made mention that you might pick up some federal money, and I don't see a federal pie slice here. Is it in the other government section, or?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
All right. And how much roughly have you gotten recently in federal funds?
Minnesota's share of the Legal Services Corporation funding is about $4.2 million, I believe. And that's the major federal funder. And then several programs also receive funding from Title III for providing services to seniors. And there are several programs that kind of get funded and then lose the funding and then get it again for VAWA funds and Department of Justice funds.
And Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Lane.
My program receives some designated federal funding specifically to serve persons with disabilities throughout the state of Minnesota. But all of those sources are on the block. None of them are going to go up.
Yeah.
The only question is how much they're going to go down.
Any other questions? Mr. Lane, I'll continue. Going to slide number 9. This breaks down the general funds and the IOLTA funding. If I compare the dollar amount to the number of attorneys, it's a little under, on average, 100,000, 90-something, I would imagine. But I'm trying to get a breakdown of what those expenses might really mean. And I was wondering if you might be able to tell us where or how that money is spent or allocated.
Mr. Chairman, it's not all salaries.
Yeah.
In fact, a starting salary average for legal services in Minnesota is, I think, below $45,000 a year. So that rough average, I'd call it sort of the cost of an attorney unit, salary, benefits, part of support staff, and costs like that added in.
Okay. And what would the other remainder of that money where would that be allocated? Is that for office supplies, rent, little of everything? Is that how it
all of the above? Yes, Mr. Chairman. Rent. You know, rent is not a variable. Health insurance only goes in one direction. Okay. In terms of cost, insurance, of course, is a cost that never goes down.
Okay. Any other questions? Well, we got a rough road to hoe, Mr. Lane.
Mr. Chairman, I'm so glad I don't have your job. Thank you for your time, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, thank you. And Mr. Lane, you're an attorney, aren't you?
I'm sorry?
You're an attorney?
Yes.
You know, Mr. Lane, as I've looked back over the years, I see you come and go every once in a while, and I've sat through a number of hearings that you've made presentation to, and I know that if you're half the attorney I think you are, we got a tremendous bargain by your service to the state of Minnesota.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. It's been a privilege.
And no, it's been our privilege. It's been the privilege of the people of Minnesota. Thank you for your service. Any other questions? Hearing none. There's no other business before the committee, and the meeting is adjourned.